I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome to another Chinchilla Squeaks interview show with me, Christian Scheller. I have dug two interviews out from way back in February for this episode. I don't know why it's taken me so long to get to them. These were all taken at the State of OpenCon, organised by Open UK in London back in February, just after FOSDEM, actually. I did three interviews there. One I'm not going to include because I heard from them recently, and we're going to rearrange that interview because they have now got their platform in a sort of public beta. So it makes more sense to maybe just do that again. But the first interview I'm going to have is with Lorna Mitchell, who works for Redockly, an API documentation developer portal platform. They also make some open source tools. We speak about her journey. We speak about APIs. We speak about documentation and numerous other things. I've known her for some time, and it's the first time we actually had a recorded conversation. I don't know why it's taken so long. And the second one is with Amanda Brock from Open UK. We have spoken a few times on the show. This is the first time in person. Some of what she says it's not up to date anymore, but I left some of it in because it was interesting, especially now as I'm recording this. We have the UK election in a couple of weeks, and hearing some of her comments around dealing with the government at the time, and that government is subject to change. It was sort of interesting hearing maybe some comments from the past, see how they apply now and how they will apply in the future. A little less of it is still relevant, of course, because of the time of the recording, but I have included some highlights of it anyway. I have some updates for you that I will get to you in the next news show. I will keep this one just focused on the interviews. But before I begin, here are a few words from sponsors. Lorna, we've known each other for a little bit of time, but I feel like we should chart your... No, let's start with who you are and where you work first, and then let's chart your journey.
Hi, I'm Lorna Mitchell. I'm VP of Developer Experience at Redockly. Yeah, I've been doing that for a bit less than a year, and I'm excited to be working in APIs and open source.
I'd actually like to maybe unpack a little bit of developer experience, because it can mean two different things to different people, like internal developer experience and external developer experience. From a Redockly perspective, which one is that mostly?
It's mostly external developer experience, because Redockly makes dev tools for other people to use. I mean, we do also use our own tools. So there are side benefits to having a good developer experience, but it's mostly about allowing our technical users to be successful with our stuff and trying to create tools that just seem familiar and that people can quickly get started with.
And I believe you just did a talk, which I think the topic was developer experience for open source tools or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Why that topic?
Well, this is a great question. And honestly, the more that I learn about developer experience as like a profession and a practice, the more I realize that it's something that we do in the corporate world that has a lot to lend us in open source. And in when you do it, developer experience, especially internally within businesses, you're looking to optimize your resources, basically looking to get more work out of your expensive engineers and to let them be happy and successful. When you do it in open source, maybe it's even more important because it's volunteer time, maintainers are a shortage resource, and so having a good developer experience, having your project well set up for contributions, having a good set of written documentation and some good automation just smooths every possible step of the way. And that's why I brought that, I thought this crowd at State of Open would understand.
So this is developer experience for bringing developers into the project, not the developer experience of the end project, per se.
Yes, giving a good, maybe it's a contributor experience, I think, but also to the end users, because in open source, they're the same people. So you have to have a tool that people can adopt and use. Otherwise, you don't have any contributors or any maintainers because, you know, I hate to use the word funnel in an open source context, but that's the truth. If no one uses your project, yeah, no one's got a reason to contribute to it.
I actually feel like, so we know each other from a while back in the Drupal days, and Drupal used to have this concept of the circles, wasn't it? I feel like that was a term people used to use then instead of funnel. It was like, you know, people start on kind of this place and you try to bring them into the next place and to the next place. And I think people called it something different in those days, but it was similar.
Yeah, and I definitely see that. And I also see there's something called the orbit model in DevRel, which is a similar thing. Like, who's heard of you? Who, like, uses your tools? Who's your champion? Who tweets about you? Who sells you internally to their customers? Like, it's... I think it's similar to some of the sales practices, but it's not like that. It's like who gets to know us and really enjoys what we make.
Yeah. Okay. Can I reduce your talk to like three top tips? Is that the kind of thing I can do, or is that not what the talk was?
I think I might have to think hard about that. I think there are some key pieces. One is to always remember that although we don't want to force everyone who ever uses an open source project to become a maintainer, right? You should be able to get out at any stage of that process. And we are all users or participants or maintainers or reviewers or, you know, contributors. We're at different levels for all the different projects.
Yeah.
But always remember that a good experience this time gives you a better chance gives that person a better chance of coming to the next level.
Yeah.
So that's one point. The other point is to use the tools that are available in your platform. So I had GitHub, GitLab, and Codeberg examples and screenshots. Codeberg is an open source, Fediverse-oriented open source, like, code repository hub thing.
Okay.
And all of them have things like, how do you write a good README? Where should your other documentation go? How do you make your project discoverable? How can you help users to participate with a code of conduct and a really good set of issue maintenance and tags and trying to make that part work? And I think the third point is to invest in the tooling setup. You know, if you in software engineering in companies, you would require your team to follow certain coding practices, branch naming practices, commit strategies, run tests, write tests, like write that stuff down and invest in the tools to optimize it, because it's respectful for both contributors who can be right first time when they open a branch, a pull request, and for maintainers, because some of that repeat work is done.
Yeah.
Because almost every contribution probably comes from a new person. And so you're explaining the basics over and over.
Yep.
So by writing it down and automating it, that's a good developer experience. And I feel like that's transferable from the corporate world to community.
So why do you think a fair amount of open source projects don't always have particularly good contributor developer experience? Yeah.
I think it can be a difficult thing to gain experience of. You know, I'm not aware of many talks like the one I've just given, which really aimed to give that practical advice. Sometimes projects just genuinely people throw out a README at the last minute, and not every project should have a lot of new users all the time.
Yep.
It is just open code that is pretty niche and it's finished and its desired audience knows about it.
Yeah.
And maybe that's fine.
Yeah.
But if there's a project which would like more users or does expect people to just pick it up, open source has to be self-serve. There's no onboarding budget.
Yeah.
Then having a clear project purpose, the tech stack, the onboarding instructions, maybe some extra documentation. I mean, you and I are documentation enthusiasts. Some of that is that the developers are not confident in what that should look like. And also, we don't have good conventions around us. Like, there are so many terrible projects. Yours doesn't look out of place if yours is terrible.
Do you also wonder if there sometimes is an intentional barrier? Maybe the project doesn't really want any big contributors, or possibly more often is that it's open source for marketing purposes, not really for any actual legitimate purpose. And so they actually kind of want to make it hard to use. or just haven't really cared because it was basically designed for five people.
Yeah, it was either designed for five people or it was of its time. You know, it was an open source demo for an API that's gone offline, or, you know, we did it in a DevRel project once. And that's fine. I think as long as those things are clear, I mean, please archive your projects when you've finished with them. That wasn't in the talk, but maybe it should have been.
That makes me quite sad when I come across something that's awesome. I'm like, it's archived.
But if you don't have the bandwidth to maintain that project, you should archive it, because somebody can fork it and make it go. And it's an honesty thing, and I think the archive is the right thing. But yeah, like you, I can feel a bit sad sometimes.
There have been the ones I've had that's a bit off topic, but it's not completely off topic. But there've been the ones I've come across recently have been archived, but then it's often distributed through something else. And the problem is, even if I fork it, the place it's available somewhere else is still problematic. Like it's the VS Code plugin store, or it's actually, the weird one where I keep encountering them recently, I'm a huge fan of the Elgato Stream Deck.
Yes.
And a lot of the plugins are inconsistently maintained. And the one I wanted to help update, like when you've archived it and I can fork it, but the plugin in the store is your one. What do we do about it? I don't know. So, and then you end up with just duplicate projects and things like that, which is a whole other developer experience nightmare, of course. Anyway, I digress. But so how... what brought you here? Because you've done, you did Drupal stuff. You were also a big accessibility person, or maybe that was more as a kind of maybe a job, I'm not sure. You have done also developer relations work. Like, what brought you to this point, what you're doing now?
That's a really great question. I like to say I'm the child of open source. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite a self-taught developer. I guess I've mostly learned when I've been in employment. But yeah, I've done a lot of PHP stuff, which is what I was doing in the Drupal space. I'm not really a Drupal person, but you've run into it. Well, I always enjoyed the Drupal events. And if you're a PHP programmer, you can probably speak at the Drupal events. And I like the humans. Yeah. So yeah, I was definitely at the Drupal things, but not doing that many projects with it.
Did you write a book? Drupal book.
I did not write a Drupal book. Almost all my books have PHP in the title, which is hilarious because PHP has changed so much that it could walk past me in the street and I wouldn't recognize it. Yeah. People ask me PHP questions and I'm like, yeah, no, you need you need to find someone who's used it this decade.
Facebook.
Yeah.
Anyway, carry on.
So after many years as essentially a web developer, an API developer, I was freelance for a while, and that was great because I wrote some books and did some training and just explored some of the other parts of my professional skill set that I was interested in. And consultancy got a bit out of hand, and then I moved into DevRel because I was at conferences all the time, and that is super expensive if you're not paid to be there.
Yep.
And that was, so I did developer relations first as a developer advocate, and then I've been a streamer, I've been a writer, we talked about the books. Then I founded a DevRel team, so I've been like a DevRel leader, a manager in an open source hypergrowth startup, which was incredible. But I've always been an API specialist. Not that I didn't enjoy working in the database space, I've sort of been backwards and forwards. You made the mention of the accessibility thing. Actually, I am not remotely interested in accessibility, but I have some accessibility needs.
It's something you bring up at a lot of other people's talks, which is always can be a bit of a curveball thing, but it's something that people overlook a lot of the time.
Yeah, but for me, it's like the diversity thing. I'm just not that passionate about diversity, but I am the only woman in the room.
Yeah.
And sometimes I have to say that because otherwise people can't see it.
Yeah.
So the accessibility thing is relevant because most PHP developers, at least when I was doing it, were reasonably full stack.
Yeah.
And I cannot use the front end.
Okay.
The browser developer tools are a no-go if you are keyboard only, which I am due to an arm injury.
Ah.
So I can still use the keyboard, but if I can't do it from the keyboard, I can't do it at all.
Okay.
Which is a fascinating way to use a computer. I mean, look, I work from home. My laptop is docked at eye level. I have a split keyboard by me and nothing else. But no one's watching me. So the fact that it's a little bit clunky because I have a lot of workarounds and computers are not really designed for this, no one can see it. Doesn't matter. I type. I touch type. I was a secretary. Yeah. There's a lot of graphics things I can't use. I use Vimium in the browser. Everything else. APIs. Doxus code, because of course that can all be done text-based, and I can choose my tool.
Yeah.
I'm not forced into Confluence or Word, or, you know, I could use any editor, and I am still predominantly a Vim user because that's designed to be done with just the keyboard. And I have the muscle memory now. Yeah. I was a secretary in my school holidays as a teenager, and I touch type. So the keyboard's fine. I can keep up.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to the last couple of years. Do you think there's a fairly logical crossover between developer relations and developer experience? Often we kind of mix and match a lot of these terms a little bit. Is that possibly why you moved from one to the other? And then there's actually quite a lot of overlap.
I would like to say that I did not move at all. But the job titles absolutely moved. Yeah, I think there's lots of crossover, or there can be. So developer relations is still a pretty young profession, I would say, like 10, 15 years old before you first started seeing those old school evangelists. And they were technical people who shared their technical expertise. I, like, had a mumble number of years of software engineering experience before I moved into the developer relations. So I come at it that way. But in DevRel, you know, we have lots of different types of roles. Every product needs something different. For some of those, you don't need, you know, 15 years of software engineering experience. You just need to be able to use the tool. So it's difficult to set the technical level because there are all of them exist. But I think in the last couple of years, developer relations, and this is a symptom of the economy, has been more marketing focused, more outward focused.
Yeah.
And like, I'm a software engineer with a writing problem. So while I can bring my communication skills into DevRel from engineering, I began to feel that advocacy was too far away from the stuff that I want to think about and really enjoy doing, and honestly have an advanced skill set doing. So developer experience, all the roles are different, but there's a big communications section, and there's also a big engineering skill set needed. And one thing that I do find now that I'm quite a bit older than most of my colleagues is there's a lot of value in just having seen a lot of this stuff before.
Yeah.
And so I bring that as well.
I actually wonder, though, you saying about that developer relations became maybe more marketing and more external, that I started with this question around, is it internal developer experience or external developer experience? But I feel like there are, especially in larger companies, there are still a lot of developer relations people who are entirely internal, enough developers that that's all they do is internal work. And it becomes more like maybe the traditional model.
Yes,
yeah.
I think so. But what I am doing, which is like developer experience externally, brings in I'm a really experienced open source project maintainer. Like, I know how to work with other people's contributions and issues. And actually, that's not a nothing skill set. We have a lot of unwritten culture in hacker space, and sort of bringing that, helping a corporation to navigate that is tricky.
Yeah.
So I'm bringing some of that. I also write the code sometimes, which typically DevRel doesn't. And in a big organization, I would be doing developer experience on this cool CLI tool for all of the tools, all of the engineering teams to use it. And now I'm doing developer experience on this cool CLI tool for a load of engineering teams to use it, but they're not our engineering teams.
Yeah.
You know, there are other people's engineering teams, but it's the crossover. I mean, I can't make them come to meetings. I just have to write interesting blog posts and hope that they get it, or that they contact us if they've got questions. Yeah, a little bit. So there's still a piece of that DevRel, and Redockly's tiny. We don't have DevRel. But in developer experience, I do work more on designing the tools and making sure the integrations work. And yeah, you can see my commits in the repo. Like, that's a real thing.
So has Redock, which is the open source part of Redock, isn't it? Has it applied your principles to its onboarding experience, its contributor, its developer experience?
Oh, tricky question. So I have been working mostly on Redockly CLI, which is our CLI wrapper for Redock, the open source open API reference docs rendering, and for all of our linting, transform, joining, splitting, tooling that's in that CLI package. Redoc itself is a little bit in a holding pattern. I have updated its docs in the year since I joined Redocly. I've no idea if I'm supposed to be telling you that there will be a new version of Redoc.
I feel like you mentioned it somewhere else already. So
you weren't recording last time, but I will start a rumor that there will be some updates to Redoc. So it's not perfect, but it's very much on my radar. Redoc is so widely known and widely used. I'm pretty excited that we're going to have some updates on that.
It's going to be published in a while as well. Let's actually, maybe we should probably wrap up with kind of a, what, we mentioned it in passing a little bit, but what is Redocly? Like, why would someone turn to it?
Redocly has a suite of really API-centric and developer portal-centric tooling. And we've talked so much about the crossover between internal and external stuff. You know, if you have an internal developer platform, it is still a developer showcase for your internal developers. So we have new platforms coming for both of those and some new API reference docs. In terms of what's available immediately today, Redocly CLI has some transform features. So if your open API isn't everything you hoped it would be, we can help you to fix those fields and update it, filter out the endpoints that shouldn't be published, or use the tagging to just change the shape. You see too many terrible open API descriptions that end up in docs, and then your docs are disappointing. Yeah. Like, we have all those toolings. And the API linting, you know, people often know some of the more long-standing tools like Spectral, but if you have, if you don't like JSON path, or if you have very large open API descriptions, then Redocly CLI is actively developed and is a little bit more geared up for those things.
Just give, actually, the thing we forgot to sort of mention in your path to here is you have actually been a flag waver for open API for a while, even before Redocly. But there were a handful of other API specs that fell along the wayside. Are there any you have a particular fond memory for that you wish hadn't fallen by the wayside? Or are you always kind of keen on open API and swagger with the precursor that some people still have used the terms interchangeably? But
yeah, open API, I feel like, has really pulled the best pieces of all of those other API descriptions. And open API as it is, I think, really serves a lot of HTTP RESTful type use cases. I'm super happy, like, Open API built on the prior art, and now we have things like Async API, which bring a lot from Open API, and we talk a lot with them. Yeah. And then you see new things coming up like GraphQL. Open API is also planning to launch to release a new version this year, and that will encompass a wider family of HTTP APIs. Okay. So, yeah, look out for Open API 4.0 sometime in late 2024, because that's going to be really interesting. And it is, although the upgrade path will be amazing because we have absolutely learned from that, it will look a bit different. So yeah,
sarcasm, or was that all?
Open API 2.3 and 3.3.1 was not an easy upgrade, but 3.1 to 4, like, we're starting with the upgrade script. It's gonna be fine.
I feel like GraphQL actually came out before Async API. I'm not sure.
Do you know, I'm not sure either.
Because I was actually looking at it for this book I'm writing. And when I looked at Async API, I was kind of looking at it thinking, between Open API and Async API, there's a little bit, without looking at the concept, but looking at the spec, I was kind of like...
There is a lot of common ground, but there are also some differences that will trip you.
Yeah.
Redocly CLI actually has lint and validation support for both. So I had to get quite deep in the weeds with the data models for both, which is great. And as I do more and more with Open API, the core specification with the Open API initiative, you know, keeping in touch with Async API is kind of part of the job there.
Okay. And to wrap up, next 6 months to a year, what's sort of on the roadmap for you and or Redocly?
Redocly has some big product launches that I may or may not have spoiled in this conversation. So that is really taking my... I mean, it's what I have to be working on, but also really takes my imagination. One of the things that we do is we're launching a new developer portal product. And, like, I love developer portals, and I've built documentation platforms the last three places that I've worked. So to be building the tools and enabling our customers to migrate or do something new is... I'm pretty excited about that. We do have some early access customers, so I am kind of already doing that. But I am also building our docs with our docs tools, which is all the emotions at once in a good way.
And you? Probably lots of speaks, lots of talks.
Absolutely no talks planned at all.
Okay.
I don't laugh. I don't speak in public anymore.
Okay.
I have given 3 talks in the last 4 days. Apart from that, developer experience for me is, you know, one of the reasons I don't necessarily do a lot of DevRel is I want to be with my hands on the product and the tech and doing those things.
Yeah.
Whereas being on the road is pretty tiring and disruptive, and I don't want to be flying a lot. I think we all need to be flying less.
Yeah.
So it's one of the reasons that I wanted to come away from it. Also, I've given a lot of talks in my life. Like, we could hear some new voices now.
Yeah.
So I don't have any speaking planned. I do intend to be doing more with OpenAPI Initiative.
Okay.
Having recovered from some burnout, I'm blogging again. So I don't want to, like, now we have it recorded, I feel morally obliged to keep writing words and sharing them with the world. And that's something that I really aspire to do. You know, I think it's always helped me to think. I thoroughly recommend writing down things you know in your blog, because then you can look them up in your blog later. It's been very kind to me, and I'm very focused on the work that we're doing at Redocly and all the things that, you know, we know we're launching, but you never quite know how that's going to go or what's next. So 6 months is a stretch, but lots of good things ahead.
Awesome. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Actually, the event has a slightly different feeling to me from previous years. I'm not quite sure why.
So what way?
I don't know. Actually, because the venue is sort of more compact, so it feels cozier in a kind of a good way.
That's good.
In some respects. I also noticed younger people, which is also good.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was an intentional thing or not.
It is intentional.
Okay, there you go.
So we took tickets that some of the speakers had, and they were only going to be here one day.
Yeah.
So we took the value of those tickets and we gave them to some of the younger people coming along. So we have people from a sixth form college.
Makes sense.
Some of them are actually coming back tomorrow because they've enjoyed themselves so much, and their tutor's been talking to us about going into the school and doing some work with them.
Yeah.
But that, it was very specific, very explicit.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we've done at the conference is launch the Open Manifesto.
Okay.
Our asks of the next government,
where
that's going to be, and our asks of the political process that we're going to see over the next year as we go to election. And you will see, if you look at the Open UK Open Manifesto, that the first ask is around developing skills across the UK. And to develop those skills, what we need to do is bring together people who have an interest in coding, ideally who've been taught to code already, and then we'll help them to contribute into open source communities. And we'll use mentors across the UK from our existing open source community to help build those skills and to coach them through making their first contributions. Hopefully that will lead to them becoming part of communities. And then the contributions can be seen on GitHub or the other repos, which over time builds a visible CV, which can be seen by employers anywhere in the world. And we're hoping will enable more and more people from the UK to build those tech skills as part of the global tech sector. And potentially that builds you the tech sector that Rishi Sunak has been talking about having. I would call it the Bay Area, he calls it Silicon Valley. But to build that, you know, the Silicon Valley, it's a solution to how you grow skills, because people are not going to walk straight into jobs without experience.
Yeah.
Source enables experience.
I mean, talking about him in particular, I think he possibly is one of these people that has a bit more of an obsession with the Bay Area than some. I kind of like the fact that you come here and it is different. And I actually kind of sort of like the fact that you can have a healthy tech scene in the UK, in Europe, and it isn't quite the same as the Bay Area.
It's
though,
not the same, but I think within open source, we are so engaged with collaborate and with China and with the rest of the world. And, you know, the conversations focus quite a lot on going beyond geopolitical borders.
Yeah.
And there have been asks to keep regulation simple. And, you know, we're looking at regulation, Trump and licensing. We talked about it in the plenaries this morning. So the simpler that can be, the more possible it is for open source people to contribute to projects across the globe.
Yeah. So on the subject of globe, actually, I kind of jumped in with that question. You were leading to a much better way of saying this a minute ago. But I've been interested to know, so Open UK is seemingly fairly active,
this event is regular, you're doing lots of active work. Is there an open Germany, an open France, an open et cetera, et cetera? Or is this something quite unique in Europe at least?
It is entirely unique in the world. There are other geographic organisations, but they have a different focus. Mm. And the thing that shifts our focus, a couple of key characteristics about Open UK that are different. And one is that we don't just focus on open source software, we focus on open technology,
yep.
which for us is that broad. We used to describe it as open source software and hardware and data, but actually it covers the shades of openness.
I actually wrote those three words down earlier.
Yeah. So, standards of AI, we feel came under those banners, but not everybody understands that. So we've started to reference all five to help people's understanding. I think the key thing that we do really differently is we focus on people. And we focus on that tech community who are contributing to open source from the UK, whether or an open data from the UK, whether they are coders, whether they're community people, whether they're data specialists, because we feel that whoever they work for, wherever in the world that is, they bring, you know, they're part of our ecosystem and our community, and that's quite different. And I believe that it's true of every country that they have people, you know, local, geographically based people who are working in that global tech sector. But my suspicion is that it's probably stronger in the UK than anywhere else in the world because the language skills.
If you
look at the community here, if you look at the people we've had up on screen, the people in our photo exhibition, you'll see a real international flavour to it because so many people have also moved into the UK to be part of that open source hub. Sorry, I'm going to take my
badge. No. That's actually an interesting perspective. I wonder, what if there's other places that could be equivalent? So I was going to initially ask, like, have people spoken to you in Germany or France or whatever wanting to do something similar and asking your experiences? But more interestingly, have people in, I don't know, India or Nigeria who also have the advantage of the language common route as well, who would actually be better place and more interesting as well, you know.
Yeah, so if I share a secret with you, which you mustn't tell anybody, we had hoped to announce here and we're not quite ready yet, so I won't share it with anybody, obviously. I'm terrible at secrets, that's why I'm outsourced. We're hoping to start to build and to support the build in other countries of local organisations that match our... I suppose it's a model. You know, it wasn't that we sat down and thought, here's the model. It's evolved over the last 4 years, but it works and it engages and people feel ownership and that they're part of the community. And of course, for every country, it will have its own flavour. We've been doing our tea and biscuits because we're British.
Yep.
Some other country would do it a different way. And I hope that at some point in the not too distant future, we'll be able to announce the countries that we're doing pilots in.
Cool.
And that those pilots will become part of an open HQ collaboration from the UK, where we help to, you say, you know, countries like Nigeria, open source Africa.
Yeah, I met the other.
They're keen to do more with us. When you see these countries, particularly the developing world, there's so much going on that I think in many ways that the global south is actually going to be the technology future.
It really is, especially at the young end as well. I am endlessly meeting, you know, a lot of really enthusiastic young developers from a lot of parts of Africa, Turkey, India, China to a different extent. And it's a huge, I can't think of a good word, but a huge amount of people.
Right, it's an ecosystem.
Yeah, that is sometimes sort of that kind of Anglo-American centric tends to sometimes, not intentionally, but sometimes unintentionally, a bit behind a bit, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think there's good engagement.
It is, yeah.
People are very open, and particularly around open source, because we're used to it being so international.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's our bread and butter.
And strangely, the online events actually helped for a lot of those people because they could attend them as well, because it's not cheap. And also there's visa issues and things like that.
Yeah, and we lost one or two speakers in the process this year due to visa issues.
But yeah. I'll do our best. Which is unfortunate, isn't it?
Next year. Yeah.
Because you do have that interesting perspective where you're not, like a lot of organizations that might be equivalent to you in other countries can be maybe more activist-like. And you sort of straddle that ground between activist policy, but also sort of having people involved who are actual practitioners as well. And it's an interesting mix, maybe.
I think we sort of sit at the intersection of engineering, business, and law and policy.
Yeah.
And I think that's important because to really do law and policy well, it has to work practically.
You know,
I suspect I and some of the others involved in Open UK are extremely practical about how things are going to pan out in the tech sector. And if you look downstairs in the basement of the conference, we have an AI policy zone.
Yeah.
I was so worried. I was worried that people wouldn't go and have their voices heard.
Yeah.
And apparently, and I've not been to see this yet, apparently the first consultation that the DCIT team did had 15 people queuing outside of the door waiting for the next one to make sure they're going to it.
Yeah.
So that's really, I think it's really important that that authentic voice of the people who are actually doing the work is heard in the process. And I don't think it has been elsewhere in the world. And I don't think it has been historically in the UK.
I'd like to dig a bit more into that maybe then. What, you know, you mentioned there's a kind of the language and some cultural commonality between the UK and America, although often it's actually wider apart than we sometimes think. But, you know, why else do you think that the UK has been particularly good, especially recently with open source projects, contributors, standards as well, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think we have a tradition around the open space. And if you look, 2011, you know, Francis Maud, Mike Bracken, Liam Maxwell led the world's first open source first strategy from the UK. And when I talk to people in other countries, as much as we might complain about open source in the UK from within the UK, everybody else has huge respect for the amount of work that's done here. And then when you look at open data, we've got organizations like Open Knowledge Foundation, Open Data Institute.
Yep.
You know, we have a tradition of that here that goes back, I think the Open Data Institute was founded in 2012.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back over a decade.
Yeah.
And that mentality around collaboration and better innovation through collaboration is really strong.
Yeah.
And I think that all leads to the situation that we're in where the UK actually has a hub feel about it. And I would really like to see that evolve more so that when anybody said to you, where am I going to hire people in the open environment, the UK is first on your list.
And switching a little to you know, we are off the coast, but we still are technically in Europe, you know.
Yeah.
Good geographically speaking. Are there any sort of European partners or, obviously you don't deal with countries, but, you know, that particularly, you know, you feel are more aligned with Open UK and UK's openness?
I think it's very different country to country. Mm. And in the UK, it has tended to be that when businesses are built here, there are a few that last at a small scale for a long time, but it's not the norm here. Businesses grow and thrive or they disappear. And the ones that grow and thrive tend to be invested in from the US, historically at least.
Yeah.
Or they're sold to the US. And I think that's shifting as we see investors understand open source better, so they understand risk better, and that makes them more inclined to invest. Historically, that's come out of the Bay Area. And I think that that has a lot to do with how the ecosystem has evolved. And when you look across Europe, what you tend to see is there's more of a culture of startups that don't have to grow.
Yeah.
And they can scale in the same way. And there's more of an ecosystem. So if you were to look at Germany, they have more SMEs.
Mittelstand is the famous word.
They don't have to grow. Whereas here, we are more in that American mindset, I think, of growing.
Actually a nice middle ground in some ways. It's not quite as extreme as America.
Right. We have more individuals working in the space than they do. They have more of these small companies. It's just a different sort of mentality and culture, I think. So, I mean, Germany and France are next in the charts around contribution. And I think it falls away after that.
And
I mean, there's obviously a lot of interest. We've talked to people in different countries about building the ecosystem out. It'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, okay.
It's a conversation for next year.
No, I think so. I think so. Well, on the subject of next year, like, you've already... I wasn't here last year. Well, I was here very briefly last year. So,
I remember.
So...
You were persuaded.
The OpenAI, which is confusing to say because it can mean, obviously, there's one thing that people think of, but you mean something else, which is good. That is a new addition, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Next year... What do you think might be something new that you add? Is it going to be this wider ecosystem?
I hope that will be next year. I hope that we will have sister organizations either in pilot or fully fledged in other countries who will come and be part of it. I have described to some of the press that we've been bringing the Bay Area to London because we have a lot of engagement from international speakers. I don't know. What else will we have next year? Movie night, because we're going to be at the British Film Institute.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah, 4th and 5th of February 2025. We're already booked up, and that's where we're going to be. Yeah. So there will be some fabulous movie night happening as part of the conference.
I've not been there for decades. Well, I think more the space, you know, I guess the AI will remain. Unfortunately, we'll see. Who knows? It could be an interesting year.
Having this policy piece, last year we had the DSIC security team do a workshop.
What does that stand for? I've been out.
Department of Science, Innovation and Technology.
Okay.
So it used to be DCMS, and DCMS split, and the key things that we interact with moved into DSIC. And what we see with DSIC now is the security team consulted with us last year, but it wasn't quite such a big consultation, and we've got the Home Office doing that this year.
Oh, cool.
Along with DSIC in the AI policy zone, and they're really trying to understand, because people like me keep saying that they're not hearing the community voices, they're hearing from companies who have different interests.
Yeah.
And what we want is for them to actually hear those individuals. It's a risk, right? Because nobody's policing what individuals are saying to the government departments, but that's how it ought to be.
Yeah.
And tomorrow we've got a last minute entry. We've got Baroness, and I don't know how I say this, and I need to learn before tomorrow. It's Heather Stolestal, and she is the chair of the House of Lords Digital and Communications Committee.
Okay.
And they conducted an inquiry from last September through to end of year.
Yeah.
And there was written and there was oral evidence, and they reported on Friday last week.
Yeah.
And she's the chair of the committee that did that report, and she's going to come and do the closing keynote for us tomorrow, which we found out yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that's really interesting about their report is that open source is not used when they're talking about AI. They use open access.
Okay.
Because they viewed it as a contested term, because clearly there wasn't a lot of the open source community getting to speak there.
Yeah.
And a lot of people try to describe it as a different thing.
You know, AI is complicated.
It is complicated, but also because there's no trademark in the term open source, it's hard to enforce and ensure it's properly defined.
Hey.
And I have to say, I would rather that they didn't use it than they defined it wrongly, which is really important. So it will be really interesting to see what she has to say tomorrow and how the community react to that, and then how that goes in the consultation.
Yeah.
Because we're doing a repeat of the consultation with DSIC in the Home Office tomorrow afternoon. So it'll be interesting to see if there's a difference in the feedback that we get after she's spoken.
Okay. And between this year and next year, I'm sure there's many other things. Like what's on the immediate, radar for the next few months?
So we will do our annual survey again in May, which allows us to do some economic calculations about the value of open source to the UK. Feed into a report that we published on the 3rd of July, and our partners at the Digital Catapult are actually going to host the launch of that for us. And I have the House of Lords books for the 28th of November for our 5th annual awards. And this year we did an AI category for the first time. And I'm disappointed that he's not going to be with us tomorrow, but Torn Bruce Richards, who is the creator and founder of AutoGPT, which is the fastest growing AI repository in the world, possibly the fastest growing open source repository, he was given the AI award, our first AI award, and he wrote for a report. He did a fireside chat, and I think it's the first interview he's ever done, which was published last week. We were a day ahead of the EU publishing a draft of the AI Act.
And no comment. So
So it's really interesting to have people like that in the ecosystem. I think sometimes when we're talking about stuff like AI, we forget how much innovation and how much opportunity comes from something like opening it up.
The complication, of course, is the data sets with that. We had this discussion was going around a lot at FOSDEM with the DevRel managers of, do we accept AI talks? Because it's sometimes like that bit is open, but is that bit? And the general consensus was like, unless it's very, very clear, no, because that's not what FOSDEM is supposed to be.
Yeah, they're slightly different. So we made a decision that we wouldn't do a track for AI talks, that we let them filter into every track through the CFP process. And then we had the space that we were going to focus on AI, and we had to work out what to do. So we've got a cinema that's showcasing AI content. And then we've got, it's quite nice if you want to go for your nap, that's the place to go. You know, a dark room with AI in it. And then next to that, we've got consultations going on in the afternoons.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah. See you next year.
Indeed. 5th of February 2025.
Thank you
very much.
No worries. Thank you again. And that was my interviews with Lorna and Amanda, recorded at the State of OpenCon back in London in February. I have a few more older interviews from KubeCon to get together. That was only April, though. So they were basically last week, really, shall we say? All right, then. So I will leave you there, and I will save a lot of updates. I have quite a few coming. Good news, bad news, changes all coming over the next few weeks and months, actually. Some regarding the podcast, some regarding some other things. So for now, I will just say thank you very much for joining me. Take care. I have been Christian Schiller, and I will talk to you again next time. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at chrischinchilla.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.